Okay, I guess as good a time as any to get going. Hi, my name is Martin Grant. I'm the Dean of the Faculty of Science. Before we get going, I've been fundraising in Ottawa the last couple of days, and there's a very good chance for an exemplary gift for the faculty, which I'd like to announce today on this special date, that we may have the opportunity to name Canada's first Department of Astrology, and it's moved me to prepare a poem. When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, then peace will rule the planets and love will rule the stars. So this will be as of April 1st, 2010. I figure, you know, bad jokes set everyone at ease really fast. The first science is astronomy. It follows from astrology, where people are looking at the stars and wondering, did they control events? But it led into true astronomy of understanding how the stars go. And many people say the last science will be astrophysics, where we understand how the universe actually works from looking at the stars in the distance. To infinity and beyond, space, stars, and the universe brings you the latest in cosmology and space exploration by McGill University experts and alumnus. 400 years ago, Galileo turned his eye to the universe with a telescope. This simple act and his subsequent observations radically altered our knowledge of the universe. The United Nations has declared 2009 the International Year of Astronomy in commemoration of the first astronomical use of the telescope. Many of the experts we have lined up for you guys over the next couple of months continue exploring the universe through the use of high-technology telescopes. Some carry out their research in the most remote regions of the Earth, in the high Arctic and Antarctica. One has even been in space. We have an astronaut for you on May 6th. All are at the forefront of exploration in their respective fields. You'll come away from MiniScience 2009 with a greater understanding of topics such as the birth of the universe, space exploration, and the search for life on Mars. MiniScience is an educational outreach program designed to offer the public an insider's view of science, so we have the real talent here on stage, the groundbreaking astrophysicists, Mars simulators, astronauts of this country will be here over the next seven Wednesdays. With that, I'll turn it over to Cappy Flanders. And Cappy, if you could give some background on the McGill mini-series.
Stand in the corner.
Thank you, Martin. Good evening, everyone. As one of the founders of the McGill Minis, Martin asked me to give you a mini history. Luckily, the minis only started in 2001, so it won't be too long a history. We started with MiniMed, which I came across at a palliative care conference in Dublin in 2000. One of the doctors at the conference who had run a program there in Dublin told me about it and also told me how to find out more about it. And as it was something that was started in the United States, it had a manual. But it did sound like great fun. And when I came back to Montreal, I sent for the manual. It was before quite as much was done on the Internet. And I got in touch with the man who started it, who happens to have been a McGill grad, John Cohen. He's now teaching at the University of Colorado in Denver. And he developed a mini-med program there in the late 80s. And it just, I think it's in over 90 schools across the United States. But I took the manual to the members of the Faculty of Medicine and then to the dean. And as they say, the rest is history. We are going to run our ninth mini-med in September. By 2005, mini-law was established. After that came mini-music and mini-science, closely followed by mini-biz and mini-ed psych. The whole thing has really been quite an eye-opener for me. First of all, to see how much is going on at McGill, the research, the teaching, and the learning. And secondly, how many people are interested in the minis. We've had over 5,000 registrants to date. Most of you, I mean, I see so many familiar faces here tonight, know the minis. So you know that the lectures aren't dumbed down. Rather, the lecturers have put their talks together in a way that we lay people can understand. I've come to understand that every profession has its jargon, and I found that it's enormously difficult for the professors to drop that and speak English. But they do, and kudos to them. The other discovery that we've made is that while we may be hesitant to ask the lecturers to take on the task of presenting a mini, once they've done it, they love it, and are often disappointed when the series is changed and they're not asked back. The minis are a partnership between the Montreal community and McGill University. It's an outreach program for McGill, an opportunity for those of us not at McGill to venture inside the gates. Your lecture series looks so exciting. I'm only sorry I won't be here for all the lectures, especially the one on May the 6th, but I won't be in country. So stay tuned, because the McGill Minis website is going to have lots more exciting news. We're going to have 3 minis going this fall. MiniMed in its 9th iteration, 2 new minis, Mini Environment, and the Principals Mini Series, which is very exciting. We're just putting it together. I'm sure you'll all be interested, and more information will be on the website soon. Enjoy the evening.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much, Kathy. The Minis is a great innovation and such a great idea, and I think a great way to provide outreach to the community. Now we're going to, as you can see in the room, we're simulating the surface of Venus to some extent. I'm sorry for it's a little warm, but I have the pleasure of introducing Wayne Pollard, who, thanks to the miracle of technology, science, and all of that, Wayne, who will be given the final lecture in the series, is currently in Axel Heiborg Island in the high Arctic. Are you there, Wayne? Oh, my.
Welcome, Martin. Greetings from Mars.
Wayne is, I'll just do a little setup, Wayne. Wayne's professor in the Department of Geography and director, I don't think I need this thing. And he's director of the McGill Northern Field Stations in Schefferville, Quebec, and the Axel Heiborg Station in the high Arctic. An area of Professor Pollard's research is polar environments as planetary analogs. And his lecture on May 13th is Exploring Mars on Earth, the Arctic as an Analog for Mars. Okay, Wayne, you're on.
Thanks, Martin. First of all, greetings from the high Arctic. I'll preface my brief talk by telling you that this is one of the most remote geostationary communication systems on Earth. We're literally at the limit of satellite communication. Okay, so basically I'll use this opportunity for a little bit of shameless self-promotion for my talk on May 13th. The acronym MARS, or the short form MARS, is not a coincidence, because the McGill Arctic Research Station, which conveniently short forms to MARS, is the basis for a Canadian Space Agency analog research site. At this site, we undertake a range of studies based on geology, geomorphology, biology, and even human factors studies that pertain to space exploration, and in particular, Mars as a target for exploration. So you can see from the slide before you right now that I'm probably further away from Montreal than the cities of Vancouver and probably London. Okay, let me advance to the next slide here. Okay, here's a Landsat image which shows the location of the field station. We're at approximately 8 degrees north. The temperature over the last few days here has been in the area of minus 35 degrees. We really haven't experienced the spring that Montreal has been experiencing. There's 2 stations here that are operated by McGill. The top picture on the left is the older station, which is approaching its 50th anniversary. And the one on the lower left is the new station, which was constructed with the help of the Canadian Space Agency. These two stations are approximately 8 kilometers apart. So basically what we do here, okay, here's a slide that shows the old station. And this is the new station. So what we do here is primarily support both McGill and McGill research activities, developing both scientific observations, technological observations, as well as human factors that deal with space exploration. In particular, looking at environments on Earth that may replicate conditions on Mars. The photograph on the left actually is a picture of the station where I am right now. And the satellite receiver, KA-Bay satellite receiver, and the arrow points to its location halfway up the side of it. It's a bit of a technological achievement, being a satellite receiver, for the reason that we were told that it wouldn't, because we're close to the limit of communication. Anyway, so my talk on May 13th will focus primarily on the activities that we do on Mars, as well as my own research, not just here at Mars, but also in Antarctica, in the McMurdo Dry Valleys. The work ranges from looking at landscapes right through to looking at environments where life may exist. And this is where the discipline of astrobiology comes in the search for life and the limits of life. The Earth's polar regions represent one of the best test environments, analog environments, in order to test our hypotheses and our theories and our methodologies that will ultimately be used in the exploration for life on Mars. And I think I'll probably end with that. And I think before I do go, though, I'll advance the last slide. This is basically what we see when I look out the window right now. I think I'll pan the camera so you can see the inside of our building here. And then I'll let you have a look outside the window. So there's my colleague, Dale Anderson. Dale's from the SETI Institute, or the Carl Sagan Institute. And Dale and I are here basically opening up the beginning of our studies for the season. And as we pan through the rest of the structure here, this is the main C-SIC. This is the main operations center. And we have a series of other structures used for laboratories and also accommodation. I'm just going to have a look outside so you can actually see what really is outside. Okay, this is basically the view outside the window. Basically, we're looking at a series of glaciers and mountains and the sea ice. Basically, it's a cold and frozen environment, right? And I think I'll end with that. So if you guys want to disconnect me, you can get on with Vicky's lecture.
Okay, that's great, Wayne. A nice way of showing that you're not actually on the second floor here. those who thought that the landscape looked rather similar to the 1969 moonwalk, I will have no comments on that on April 1st. We said there'd be no homework and no exam, but there will be a test next week based on this week's lecture, and we'll do that every week. So you should come prepared for skill testing questions. At the end of tonight's lecture, we'll ask you to write down questions and pass them to Catherine, pass them around, and Catherine, who's right here, will sort them and then say, ask this question, ask that question, Martin, and I'll ask them to Vicky. The ones we don't get to, we'll post them on the website. Please don't ask any questions you wouldn't want us to answer in front of an auditorium. Please complete the evaluation form, mentioning the room is too hot, which I can already tell, and anything else that you think would be of value. And please turn off your, I'll try to do this when I'm not in public here, but turn off any cell phones you have so they don't cut through the talk. Okay, so who have we got for you today? We have Victoria Caspi, a renowned astrophysicist who sheds light on cosmic mysteries and has built an academic program from scratch in the Department of Physics of McGill University. She's professor of physics here. She is the Lauren Trottier Chair in Astrophysics and Cosmology. And a little bit of truth in advertising here is that Lauren Trottier is sitting in the second row to check Vicky out today. She's also the Canada Research Chair in Observational Astrophysics, was recently elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. She graduated from McGill with a BSc and went on to complete an MA and PhD in physics at Princeton. She returned to McGill from MIT to accept a professorship and to found the Pulsar Group at McGill University. Under her direction, McGill has become the country's locus of high-energy astrophysical research. Since returning here, she has earned a constellation of major awards, the Stacey Prize in the Natural Sciences, the first time McGill has won that award for 30 years, the Rutherford Memorial Medal of the Royal Society of Canada, the Canadian Association of Physicists Hertzberg Medal, and the Prix Urgell Archambault from LACFAS. So you might be thinking, Vicky's like this well-established, 65-year-old close to retirement. Well, judge for yourself. Vicky, you're on.
I can talk. Oh, there we go. All right, excellent. Okay. 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 Well, it really is a pleasure to be here. My title of my talk is Neutron Stars, Lighthouses of the Cosmos. I want to start, though, by bringing up an image not of a neutron star at all. This is an image taken with a regular optical telescope of a part of the sky that is actually only visible from the southern hemisphere. This is the Large Magellanic Cloud. I'm just going to adjust this thing. This is just so Britney Spears I can't wrap my head around it. I feel like I should start dancing. So this is a Large Magellanic Cloud. This is actually a galaxy, a small galaxy that's a satellite galaxy to our Milky Way galaxy. And as I said, it's only visible from the southern hemisphere. So if you've ever been to Australia or to South America, you may have noticed it in the sky. It looks like a cloud. That's why it's called a cloud. You think it's a cloud, except that it's there every night when the sky is perfectly clear. I'm bringing it up because there was a very important celestial event that occurred sort of in this region of the Large Magellanic Cloud in 1987. It was a supernova. And if you had gone and looked at a particular region of the Large Magellanic Cloud, indicated with this arrow, which is not actually in the sky. So it would be really nice if the arrows were there. They'd be so helpful, but no. And this is what the sky would have looked like before February 23rd, 1987. Just pretty ordinary. There's a star there. Yeah, well, there's lots of other stars. But on the night of February 23rd, 1987, this star underwent a massive explosion called a supernova. And it's actually a funny story about it. There was a this was discovered by a Canadian graduate student who was observing at a telescope in the southern hemisphere and who was looking at his computer screen from inside the control room of the telescope. And there was this really annoyingly bright thing on his screen, and he couldn't figure out what was going on, and he rebooted he just couldn't understand. And he finally had the presence of mind to stand up and go outside and look up. And this was easily visible with the naked eye. In fact, the supernova greatly outshines all the other stars combined in the initial phases. So this picture doesn't do it justice because it saturates the detector. But he discovered it, and this was caused a sensation. The first naked eye observable supernova since the invention of the telescope. Some people think that it's called 1987A because it was discovered by a Canadian. That's not true. It was the first supernova in the year 1987 that was observed, so that we letter them. Now, you might wonder, okay, that was in a satellite galaxy. Fortunately, it's a close galaxy to the Milky Way, so it could be seen. But you might wonder, do these events happen in our own galaxy, which is much, much larger, so has many more stars and many more opportunities for supernovae? The answer is yes. And we know of objects that are remnants of these kind of explosions. This is one of them. This is a remnant of a supernova that we know went off in the Milky Way galaxy on July 3rd or 4th in the year 1054 AD. This is very well established. It's witnessed and recorded by Asian astrologers, and I use the word astrology here very deliberately because they were watching the sky specifically for prognostications of political events on Earth. Is the emperor going to lose the war, etc.? They believed that changes in the sky were telling them things, so they actually recorded things really impressively. I'm talking about the Koreans, the Japanese, Chinese. And we know that at that time it was visible, this event was visible in the daytime for 23 days, over 3 weeks, big bright object in the daytime, and then at nighttime for 623 days. And in fact, in the daytime, it was as bright as the full moon. So this is a very, very large event. And it was discovered in modern times by the French astronomer Charles Messier as this sort of fuzzy blob, which it has been observed to be expanding slowly. It's called the crab, by the way, because at the time Messier discovered it, of course, they didn't have photographic film, so people would look and sketch, and his sketch looks a little bit like the pinchers of a crab, so that's why it's called the crab. In any case, it's actually quite an interesting story because this object is visible from the northern hemisphere, and I mentioned the recordings are only the Chinese and the Koreans and the Japanese. There's no European or North American recording of this. And it could not have been cloudy for so long. The idea is that it might have been seen, but the prevailing religious dogma at the time in Europe said that the heavens were unchanging and they weren't going to record sudden huge events like this. That just really flew against their beliefs, and so that's at least the theory why we don't find recordings of it. Although in North America there is a possibility of a cave drawing by the Anasazi Indians, a cave pictogram in Chaco Canyon, New Mexico. Some people have argued that this star here is the supernova of 1054. The approximate dating is right, and in fact, if you figure out where the moon was relative to the supernova back in 1054, it was actually a crescent moon very close on the sky. And so that's why people think this was the birth of the Crab Nebula, except that the crescent should have been the other way. So maybe they weren't being that careful observers. We're not sure. So it might not be what we think. This is a picture of the Crab Nebula with a modern, large 8-meter telescope. And I just wanted to, first of all, it's obviously a beautiful image. It's really lovely to look at. This is not what you would traditionally call a false color image. If your eyes had the sensitivity of if your eyes were 8 meters big, then this is what you would see. But I just wanted to point out that this is really a very complex object You see these red filaments. Basically, this is all very hot gas. As I said, it's observed to be expanding. This is the remnants of the outer parts of the star that exploded. And also notice this sort of ghostly, gaseous, bluish glow. That's a different component. That's a separate component from the filaments. And we believe that this actually is being powered by an object near the center of this, an object that was created in the same explosion and a neutron star. Let me explain to you a little bit about that. First of all, the existence of neutron stars is one of the great successes of theoretical physics. So many times observations lead theory. We find bizarre, strange objects, and then the theorists go off and figure out what they are. But this was the opposite. In 1934, two very famous astronomers, Walter Botta and Fritz Zwicky, in the prestigious proceedings of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, proposed, "With all reserve, we advance the view that a supernova represents the transition of an ordinary star into a neutron star. Such a star may possess a very small radius and extremely high density." And this, at the time, seemed like science fiction. In fact, the evidence, observational evidence for neutron stars, as I'm going to show, didn't come until the late 1960s, over 30 years later. It's also remarkable that they made this prediction only 1 year after the actual discovery of the particle called the neutron itself. 1 year later, they were already proposing neutron stars. Now, why would they come to that crazy-sounding prediction? Where did this come from? Well, to understand neutron stars and what they are, how they form, first you have to understand what a star is, and in particular, what kind of star goes and produces a neutron star, because not every star, the sun will never produce a neutron star, for example. So what is a star, first of all? A star is basically a giant ball of gas. Now, it's huge masses involved here, and we all know that gravity likes to pull mass together. So in a star, as in any massive object, it tends to want to collapse because of gravity. Material gets pulled inward. But in a star, what's happening is the collapse doesn't occur because of the tremendous densities and pressures and high temperatures at the center of the star, that nuclei, not atoms, this is all the electrons are long stripped off in the centers of the star. The nuclei actually fuse. You have nuclear fusion going on in the centers of all stars, including our own sun, where the energy produced by the fusion, mostly of hydrogen into helium, that energy is what's allows the star to withstand the crushing inward pull of gravity. So it's the stability, this between the inward pull of gravity and the pressure at the center powered by nuclear fusion. This is how a star works. But of course, a star can only support itself while the nuclear fuel at the center lasts. Eventually, it runs out of fuel. Eventually, you've burned up all the hydrogen, and actually, after you burn up the hydrogen, you can fuse helium, and you can fuse all sorts of different elements. And it turns out, for arcane nuclear physics reasons, once you've fused enough nuclei that you form iron, and you could say, why iron? But it's just how it works. It's a long lecture in nuclear. Just take it on faith. This is well-established nuclear physics. Once iron forms in the core, and the core of the star has a major problem because you cannot fuse anything to iron and get out any energy. In fact, it takes energy to fuse things to iron. So once the star forms iron in its core, the nuclear reactions can no longer proceed, and the star cannot withstand this crushing inward pull of gravity. And at that point, it implodes, literally. In fact, here's a nice picture, the birth of a neutron star. Here's one of these massive stars that will form a neutron star. And incidentally, like I said, the sun is never going to form a neutron star. It's only stars, we think, with masses more than about 8 times the mass of the sun that will form a neutron star. And we think up to around 40 times the mass of the sun they form neutron stars. Beyond that, we believe they form black holes when they run out of nuclear fuel. So a neutron star is sort of a close cousin of a black hole. If you have a massive enough star, you're going to form a black hole. But from about 8 to about 40 solar masses, when the interior of the star implodes, collapses, because the nuclear fuel has run out, you form what happens in the case of a neutron star. You form the neutron star, and all the falling in matter basically bounces off the surface, careens outward, and sends the rest of the star into interstellar space, traveling at thousands of kilometers per second. And what you're left with is a neutron star at the center with the ghostly filamentary supernova remnants, like the crab, flying outward. So that's the picture of how a neutron star is born. And you might be wondering, are there any big supernovae about to happen in the galaxy? And the answer is sure. There's lots of stars that are ready to go supernova any time in the next 10,000 years or so. It could go. So in particular, you see, it's astronomical time scales. 10,000 years to an astronomer is a blink of an eye. We tend to, you know, as human beings, we measure things in, you know, centuries, but in astronomy, 10,000 years is really not much time at all. So, for example, one star that is really ready to go is Betelgeuse, the famous reddish star in the constellation of Orion, which you can notice from the belt here, the three stars in the belt, and the very bright star at the bottom called Rigel. And there's also, if you have binoculars, you can easily see this. You can even see the little Orion Nebula. There's this region of star formation. Anyway, Betelgeuse is ready to go off any time in the next few thousand years, so just get ready for that. Now, I said in the Crab Nebula that this neutron star was powering this ghostly emission. Now, what do I mean by neutron star? So in the center of the crab, I said it's a neutron star, but this neutron star is actually quite special. It's a special neutron star because it's a pulsar. And what do I mean by a pulsar? Well, if you take pictures of this inner region of the Crab Nebula, and you take pictures really quickly, so this sequence lasts about 30 milliseconds. That is about 30 times per second. What you see is the one star here is a boring, ordinary, dull star that's always on, like the sun. And if you look at the time sequence, I think it actually goes across like this. But if you look at the time sequence, you see suddenly, another star suddenly appears and then disappears and then comes back again and then disappears. And what's happening is that it is turning on and turning off and turning on and turning off very, very quickly. In fact, 30 times every second, so that if you could observe the Crab Nebula with the naked eye, your eye couldn't even detect that the lights was that it was flickering 30 times a second. Some people claim to be able to detect that, but most people cannot. So we say that this pulsar is pulsating 30 times every second. And what do we really think is physically happening? Why is it turning off and on? It's not that it's pulsating like a heart pulsates. We think what's going on, or really there's a lot of very strong evidence to support this, that the star is rotating. It's the pulsating that we see is rotational. We have a rotation axis, in this case vertical, and then we believe there's a magnetic axis and magnetic poles out of which the radiation, light, is being beamed. And so each time the star rotates, this beam, if you're lucky enough to happen to be in the beam, you see a flash. Let me just show you that again. So you go around and you see a flash. And from this cartoon, and this really is a very greatly simplified cartoon. You know, it's not just a purple ball, and it's not just yellow beams. There's all sorts of other stuff going on. Oh, and incidentally, what we actually observe is we cannot observe this object directly. We don't see this going on. It's much too small for modern telescopes to be able to resolve. It looks like just a pure point source to us. What we detect is the changing intensity of light. So what you have plotted here is basically intensity, where it's off. This would represent zero intensity. It's off, and then as the pulse flashes by, your face or the telescope, basically, you get it turns on and then goes off again. So this is a measure of the intensity that the telescope receives. A slightly more complex, but really only slightly more complex, artist's picture of a pulsar here actually shows you that the magnetic field a little more clearly. In blue here is depicted the what we think are magnetic field lines inside of which we say that the star has a magnetosphere. And in fact, the Earth has all of these things. The Earth has a magnetic field, as you know, if you use a compass. You know how a compass works. And in fact, in the Earth, the magnetic axis is not aligned with the spin axis. So the magnetic North Pole is not at the geographic North Pole. It's off by, I forget, I think 10 or 12, maybe 13 degrees. And in fact, it sort of moves around. It's kind of strange. The Earth's magnetic field wanders a bit. So this phenomenon of having a misaligned magnetic and spin axis is quite common to astronomical bodies, planets, stars, neutron stars. Now, I thought I'd say just a few words about the discovery of pulsars, because it's quite a famous story how these things were discovered. They were discovered by accident. It was a serendipitous discovery, and it was made by a graduate student named Jocelyn Bell in 1967. And there's Jocelyn standing next to a telescope. So that might not look like what you think of as a telescope, but it is. It was one of the most sensitive telescopes at the time. It was a radio telescope. So I haven't said this yet, but most pulsars are detected by their radio waves. Radio waves, just another form of light. The light that we see from lamps and from the sun, that's optical light that our eyes happen to be sensitive to. But if you just make the wavelength a little longer, you end up with radio waves, and that's just another form of light, another form of electromagnetic radiation. And that's what this antenna array, and basically these are wooden posts, that's not the telescope. The telescope are these wires that are strung on these posts in which radio waves induce currents, which are then detected by electronics. Just in the same way that, you know, your radio with its antenna or your television works, it detects the radio waves, which then get translated into images or sound by electronics. So she's standing next to the radio telescope. And in fact, this is a reproduction of the original data recording. So at that time, they didn't have computers or anything like that to record. What they did have is they had the output of this radio telescope, which is basically a current, an electric signal, plugged into a chart recorder. And a chart recorder was a device that had paper and a pen, and the paper slowly moved along, and the pen deflected each time the power received by the telescope changed. So if the telescope was off, the pen didn't move, and you just got a straight line. And if the telescope was receiving signals, then the pen moved around, and you could tell as the paper moved. And so what this is the trace of parts of the sky, one part of the sky, passing overhead at 19 hours, 20 minutes on the 6th of August, 1967. And what you see, actually, this was just power that is due to terrestrial interference. Somebody with their, not a cell phone in this case, in 1967, but, you know, some radio or some sort of transmission. And then this other bit of scruff, as Jocelyn herself described it, that to her looked different. And you look at that, it doesn't look that different, but to her it looked different, because she had been examining reams and reams and reams of this paper. And it looked so different that it was actually transiting in the middle of the night. This was a transit telescope. You can't steer it. You can only see what's exactly overhead as the Earth turns. So she went out in the middle of the night, and she turned up the speed of her chart recorder paper so that the paper would come through faster so that you could see the deflections with greater time resolution. That is, you could see what this little bit of scruff is. You could expand it this way. And what she saw was that the scruff was not just random motions, but actually individual pulsations. In this case, negative going, even though the power is positive. The telescope doesn't actually suck power out of the sky. It's receiving power. You could see these individual pulsations, which was totally unheard of at the time. You know, at the time, all known stars were just on. They didn't flicker. Nothing went beep, beep, beep in the sky. That was, you know, really shocking. And in fact, she went to her supervisor, Anthony Hewish, a professor at Cambridge University, and said, this is what I found. And he said to her, that's terrestrial interference. It's man-made. Just ignore it. And she went back, and she noticed that actually it was, if it's any astronomy aficionados, it was transiting with sidereal time. That is, anyway, it's a little, it's a clear signal that it's attached to the sky and not to something on Earth. And she proved this to him, and so as I say, she convinced him of the reality of the signals, and their group kept this discovery secret for weeks because they really believed they had detected extraterrestrial intelligence. And they referred to them as little green men. And they felt that this was just too big to report immediately to the public. And but Jocelyn went back through the reams and reams of paper that had been collecting from this telescope for years and years and years, and suddenly started finding all these little bits of scruff all over the sky. It became clear that this was a natural phenomenon confined to the plane of the Milky Way, actually, for the most part. And it was clear then that this was a natural phenomenon, a new kind of star that pulsated. And Anthony Hewish won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of pulsars in 1974. Yes, so there's a lot of literature written about this that it really was an unfortunate decision to exclude her from the Nobel Prize. You could speculate why that might be. She is very gracious about it and says that perhaps the committee felt that it would somehow diminish the importance of the prize to give it to a student. Some people have argued that the discovery of pulsars was predetermined by the construction of the first ever telescope that had sensitivity to rapid time variability in stars, which is true. But some people just think it was pure sexism. And at the time, when the press descended, Hewish was asked questions about neutron stars and all sorts of things, and she was asked questions about if she had a boyfriend and things like that. This isn't even me editorializing. What I'm saying is pretty unbiased. It's all in the, you could Google the whole story. It's all, anyway, I just thought I'd mention that Jocelyn and actually Anthony Hewish visited McGill in 2007 for a conference we held here, the 40th anniversary of the discovery of pulsars. You may have heard her on CBC Radio Noon, where she was interviewed by Anne Lagasse-Dowson. Okay, but back to some science. That was a little historical interlude. Back to a little bit of science. So these neutron stars are really amazing objects, it turns out. The typical mass of a neutron star is 1.4 times the mass of the Sun, which, just to put it into a unit that might be a little more familiar, that's 500,000 Earth masses. I'm sure we think about Earth masses on a daily basis, but that's 500,000 Earths, so that's pretty massive. But what's amazing is that it is crushed down to a radius of only 10 kilometers. That's a very human, person, not human, but city-sized distance. So you have to appreciate 500,000 Earths crushed into 10 kilometers. The density of material in a neutron star is extremely high. It is, if you were to go to a neutron star, which I don't recommend, and take a teaspoonful of it, it weighs a billion tons or some crazy number like that. This is not matter like we know it. And in fact, like I say, if this is matter in its most dense observable form. And I say observable because there are, yes, black holes are infinitely dense, but we can't really observe black holes directly. Now, if that sort of density, the other thing I meant to mention is that density is actually higher than in the atomic nucleus. So you have to remember, nucleus, atom, you have the nucleus, you have the electrons flying around. It's mostly empty space. Everything around here is mostly empty space. The nucleus is tremendous density here, and the nuclei at the centers of neutrons, the densities at the centers of neutron stars, we believe are, in fact, as high as 10 times nuclear density. And incidentally, at that density, we don't really know how matter works. That's actually an open question. The behavior of matter at ultra-high densities, we don't know. There's many theories, but we don't really know. Anyway, as if all that density stuff wasn't bizarre enough, these things also rotate very rapidly. And in fact, the fastest one rotates 716 times per second. You have to think about that. Just think about it. I mean, you know, I've said that sentence, I don't know, maybe, you know, 100 times, and still it just blows my mind every time I say it. Like, how can that? Anyway, just to set the physical scale here, here's, MapQuest, Island of Montreal. If you brought a neutron star to Earth, you know, it's about the same size. So you have 1.4 times the mass of the sun crushed into the size of a city, rotating as fast as your household blender. And actually, I was curious about that. And I wondered, what is the fastest blender? So late at night, I Googled fastest blender, and I came up with the Vitamix 5000. Its website claims it's the fastest blender on Earth, but it maxes out at 625 rotations per second, whereas Pulsar, as we know, we have one at 716, so we beat that. I actually once gave a talk, and there was a biologist in the audience, and he pointed out that centrifuges in biology labs can rotate much faster than that. So I was kind of bummed by that. So we're going to look. We're going to keep looking for faster ones just to beat the biologists. I thought I should mention that this fast pulsar, the 716 rotation per second pulsar, was actually discovered here at McGill University, just one floor above where you're sitting right now, on a computer cluster, which we call the Borg, by graduate student Jason Hessels. There's Jason next to the Borg. It broke a 23-year-old record for the fastest pulsar ever. And we are continuing to do this kind of research. We're very interested in finding even faster pulsars for reasons I'm going to explain shortly. The discovery was published in Science magazine, and there was a little article written by Josh Grinley from Harvard University titled "A Neutron Star in F Sharp." You might wonder why he would have called it a neutron star in F sharp. What does music have to do with this? Well, in fact, if you could, and in fact you can, as I'm about to show you, take the signal from a radio telescope, which after all is just an antenna, and plug it into a speaker. You know, you have to amplify it a little bit. Plug it into a speaker and listen to the sounds of pulsars. You know, they are tones. They are notes that you could put on a musical scale. And this one happens to be close to F sharp. Let me show you exactly what I mean. And I'm going to have to do some highly technical tricks here so that you could hear it. I hope you'll be able to hear this. I've brought here some sounds for you, sounds of pulsars. Again, so this is just taking a radio telescope output, plugging into a speaker. The first one I'm going to play for you is pulsar 0329 plus 54. The name, by the way, is for the coordinates in the sky. And this one has a pulse period, that is, it rotates every 0.7 seconds. Oops, sorry. Can you hear that? Make it louder. So each one of those beats is the beam of the pulsar passing over the Earth. Now the next one I'm going to show you is pulsar 0833 plus minus 45, one of the brightest pulsars in the sky. It's also in a supernova remnant called the Vela supernova remnant, so we call this one the Vela pulsar. Its period is 89 milliseconds. That means it rotates about 11 times a second, and you're going to, it sounds a little bit like a helicopter. And just by listening to this, you hear modulation, actually. If your ears are good, you'll notice that sometimes a pulse is missing. But the next one always comes back right at the right time. So in other words, these beats actually are incredibly regular. Yes, they sound a little different from one pulse to the other, but they always happen at the right time. And in fact, you could set your watch by pulsars. And in fact, not just your watch, some pulsars, the stability of this beating, if you consider it like a clock, rivals those of the world's best atomic time standards. In fact, we can't say they're better because it's hard. If your best clock, you're timing against your best clock, you don't know which one is better. That's actually an active area of research also. Anyway, this one, 0531 plus 21, is the Crab pulsar, 33 millisecond period. And right now we're starting to get into the regime where your ear can't quite separate the different pulses. Maybe you could still hear sort of like a vibration, but it's sounding less and less like individual pulses just because of the processing of your brain. Oops, sorry. I have to stop it. Oops, come back here. Okay. The last one is pulsar 1937 plus 21, which is it was actually the previous record holder before we found our pulsar. This one has a spin period of 1.5 milliseconds, which means it's rotating 642 times per second. And now you're going to understand why that article was called the neutron star in F sharp, because it's going to sound like a musical tone. Isn't that pretty? Now, these are not perfect tones. So if any musicians and a little music theory, this is not a perfect sine wave. These signals, you know, the pulse is on for a very brief part of the whole rotation period. So in musical terms, it has many harmonics. It's not a lovely, perfect tone, but it is, music of the heavens. You might wonder, okay, if you have this object rotating so fast, what is the speed of rotation? What is it, if you're standing on the surface of the neutron star, say you're standing on the equator and it's rotating 642 times per second, what speed are you moving at? And it's actually interesting, and this is an equation, so I apologize for this. I couldn't resist. But it's really simple. It's not that, don't panic. It's okay. I won't put it on the test. This is velocity here, and this is 2 pi r. That is just the diameter. That is the distance. If you're at the equator of the neutron star and you go around once in the period, in the time it takes to go around once, so 2 pi times 10 kilometers, that's the distance in the time, distance divided by time, that's the speed, in 1.5 milliseconds, that's 4 times 10 to the 7 meters per second. That is 14% of c, which is the speed of light. Okay, 14% of the speed of light. So there you go, velocity. That's very fast. It's a technical term there, very fast. And a question you might be asking yourselves, and we certainly ask ourselves as well, how fast can a neutron star spin? Because if it's going to get much faster, it's going to start to reach the speed of light, which a certain Albert Einstein told us was a cosmic speed limit that we cannot exceed, that the laws of nature do not allow us to exceed. So one of the questions we ask, research questions we're asking here in the McGill Pulsar Group is, how fast can a pulsar spin? Can we find one that would imply a velocity as close as speed of light? And that would actually not violate Einstein's theory. What it would instead do is constrain the size of the neutron star very well, because I put in 10 kilometers here, but actually there's some wiggle room there. It could be 12, it could be 8. It's not 1,000, and it's not 0.1 kilometers. We know it's somewhere between, 5 and 30 kilometers. We're pretty sure about that. So if we found one spinning at sea, it would really be telling us about the size. And what this is, and this isn't just sort of an exercise in superlatives, we want to find the fastest. No, by finding and constraining the size of a neutron star, we are actually learning about the behavior of matter at ultra-high densities. I said before, we don't know how matter behaves in these extremely high densities, 10 times nuclear density. By finding objects and measuring their radii, we can rule out different models for the nature of matter at these very high densities. I only have a few minutes left, so I'll show you one other interesting thing. You might wonder, well, how do these stars get to spin so fast? How do they spin up? Where do they come up with these crazy spins? Well, most of the answer, not all the answer, but most of the answer comes from a principle that's called the conservation of angular momentum. This is something we learn in Physics 101 and is actually very nicely illustrated by skaters. Skaters use this principle of conservation of angular momentum all the time. And I'm going to show you a movie of this skater. It's actually Todd Eldridge, a U.S. Olympic medalist. I should really I've been trying to find a Canadian one. I haven't so far. But what you're going to see is him doing a spin where he's going to give himself a torque. He's going to make himself spin with his arms out and one leg out. So he's making himself as large as he possibly can physically. And then as he spins, he's going to bring his arms inward and bring that leg inward, and you're going to see he's going to spin up much faster. And this is what conservation of angular momentum is all about. For the same angular momentum, when he becomes smaller, his spin has to amplify. His rotation rate has to amplify. So let's could watch this movie here. There he goes. Torque himself. There he goes. He starts to spin. See, his leg is out, his arms are out, and now slowly he will pull everything in, and you see he's going to spin faster and faster till he drills himself down to China, and there you go. And this picture is the same for stars. All stars rotate. The sun rotates. The sun rotates roughly once every 27 days. This is well known for centuries. As long as you could observe just the sunspots, you could see that they're going around roughly every 27 days. So the idea is that the neutron star progenitor, the star prior to supernova, star that exploded, had some rotation. And then the implosion, shrinking, taking all the matter from the core, shrinking it to the neutron star, amplified the rotation. And that's how the Crab pulsar got to be spinning about 30 times every second. I said it's part of the answer. It's not quite right for the millisecond, for the pulsar spinning faster than a few hundred times a second. There's a whole other story there that I don't have time to share with you, although I'd love to. But I see I'm running out of time. So let's see. Let's skip that. Okay. So I think I'll end with this slide just to tell you basically why I study neutron stars, why I think they're so interesting. They represent tremendous laboratories for doing for studying extreme physics, matter under some of the most extreme conditions in the universe, conditions which cannot replicate in terrestrial laboratories. I've shown you one example of this, where the density at the center of neutron stars is higher than atomic nuclei, so we get to study the nature of matter at very high density. I alluded briefly to the fact that these objects have superb clock-like properties, and it turns out that they are excellent laboratories for studying general relativity and other theories of gravity. And if I had more time, I actually had a movie showing a result that we had recently testing general relativity in a paper we wrote in Science just last year. And in fact, the first time that this was demonstrated was by Joe Taylor, who is actually my PhD supervisor at Princeton, and his then graduate student Russell Hulse, who jointly won the 1993 Nobel Prize for the demonstration, for actually the discovery of the first so-called binary pulsar, a pulsar rotating around another star, which they then used to test general relativity. So neutron stars as physics laboratories, densities, testing theories of gravity. Also, neutron stars have the highest magnetic fields known in the universe. And the behavior of matter in those magnetic fields is not well understood, not well tested, supposedly well described by Richard Feynman's QED theory, but not well. In some aspects of that are not very well tested in laboratories. And we use ultra-highly magnetized neutron stars, which we actually call magnetars, to do these kind of tests as well. So neutron stars, they're unique in that they are extreme, yet they are observable. So it is people who like to study black holes, and at the risk of sounding like the Johnny Cochran of astronomy, black holes, they may be clean, but neutron stars can be seen. they're extreme, yet they're observable by telescopes. And I think I will end there and thank you for your attention.
And now I'll ask people if they could prepare questions for Vicky, and they'll be picked up and passed up to me. And I've got a wonderful gift to give Vicky, which I don't know what it is, but here you go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a great talk.
Do I get to open it?
Yeah, open it. Okay. People writing down questions. Yeah. Sure. Don't be shy.
Oh, a mug. Oh, not just a mug.
It's not just a mug.
Not just a mug. Oh, look how beautiful. Oh, it has my name on it. It's a beer mug.
It's a beer mug suitable for drinking beer with.
Thank you very much.
And just raise your hands and we can pick up the questions, or we'll have to fall back on my questions. And we're rocking. Okay, good. Okay. Okay, Vicki, now you're on the spot because we have our trained panelists have questions for you. So here's the first question. Is it true that when we look at stars in the skies, they have technically died out to them being light years away from us?
They have technically what? Sorry.
Died out.
Oh, right. So the short answer is no. But it's actually quite a question is raising a very important point that light does travel at a finite speed. It's not infinitely fast. So objects that are very, very far away, it takes light a long time to get here. And so when you are looking out to large distances, you are looking back in time. So it is possible that some of the objects that we're seeing now, yes, maybe some of them have died out. But in general, that's not true. In general, stars live for many, many millions of years, billions of years in the case of low-mass stars. So most of them have not died out. It is possible some of them have, because you are looking. There's a long time delay between when the star emits the light when you receive it.
Yes. I forgot to announce that good handwriting is a plus for the dean. We don't mark solely on handwriting, but it is a good handwriting is appreciated. This is an interesting question, actually, Vicki, because a lot of your stuff is on two of them spinning around. And the question is, what happens or why don't two neutron stars merge?
Oh, what a good question.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. Well, okay, so that question is a very sophisticated question because I didn't get to, I would have loved to, and I have about 10 slides, but I'll resist. So, yes, we find neutron stars in orbits around other neutron stars. So we find neutron stars in orbits around all sorts of things, around solar types. Well, yeah, there's solar types. You know, around massive stars, around low-mass stars, and around other neutron stars. We know double neutron star binaries, I'd say we know something like a dozen of these objects. We're always looking for them. They're really interesting to study. And, in fact, some of them orbit at relativistic speeds. So, okay, my slide disappeared. I mentioned that the tests of general relativity, that's done using binary neutron stars, double neutron stars, where the orbits, the time it takes for the one star to go around the other is a few hours. So, you know, the Earth goes around the Sun once every year. You can imagine in orbits where it's just a few hours, then Kepler's laws don't adequately describe the orbit you need general relativity. That's how the tests of general relativity are done. And in fact, one of general relativity's basic tenets is that very massive objects that are moving also emit what's called gravitational radiation. So just like you take a charge, you take an electron and you move it in an antenna that produces electromagnetic radiation, radio waves, and so forth, when you move masses around, you get gravitational radiation. And if you emit radiation, the binary loses energy, and the neutron stars, yes, they will eventually merge. So the answer, I forget exactly how the question was worded, what happens, yeah, so if they merge, which we believe does happen, we think what it produces is a huge burst of gamma rays. And we don't think that because there's a theory of what happens radiatively when two neutron stars merge. We think that because we observe huge gamma ray bursts in the sky, and this is a whole other phenomenon. You could have a whole talk about this. Discovered in the early 1970s, about once a day there are these huge gamma ray bursts in the sky that we think a large fraction of them, probably most of them, are merging neutron stars. So you get a huge explosion, possibly formation of a black hole, or maybe total disruption of the stars, but you definitely get a big explosion.
Okay. And this one's a good one, and I can see people are worried. Will our sun go supernova? And if so, and if it doesn't become a neutron star, what's up with that? What will happen?
Right. Okay. So the supernova that I described, that will only happen to very massive stars. Stars roughly more massive than about 8 times the mass of the sun. So the sun is a relatively low mass star, and it will not produce a neutron star. It doesn't have the core collapse. You could think of it as there's not quite enough mass, therefore, to have a core collapse. And instead what happens is it will undergo various phases where it will expand. It'll undergo a red giant phase. It'll actually swallow up the solar system, sorry to say. But, you know, this is going to happen in roughly something like 100 million to a billion years. So really don't worry. No, don't sweat this. But after that, it will then begin to contract. And eventually, the ultimate end product of a star of the mass of our sun, and really most stars below about 8 solar masses, is that turn into white dwarf stars. White dwarfs, these are relatively compact objects also, about the radius of the Earth. So not 10 kilometers, about the radius of the Earth, but the mass of, the sun. And these are very interesting objects themselves. And some of the world experts on white dwarf stars actually are just down the road at University of Montreal. Okay.
What happens to the rest of the debris when the supernova goes boom?
So most of the mass gets shot out into interstellar space. That's what happens to most of it. Some of it forms a compact object, either a neutron star or a black hole. Some of it also might fall back onto the compact object. And in fact, that's a very interesting research question these days. It could be in some cases that you could form a neutron star, but then extra matter falls onto the neutron star rather than careening outward, and you could have a neutron star forming briefly and then another collapse to a black hole. There's some evidence that happens, but no direct observation of that yet.
Here's kind of the complementary question. Is it thought that a neutron star is purely made of neutrons, or does it have other stuff inside it?
Yeah, so it's mostly neutrons, but it's not exclusively neutrons. And in fact, so I say, I sort of use these terms loosely, but yes, the density, the average density is like nuclear matter. At the center, the density is 10 times nuclear, but at the surface, it's actually a little bit, it's not nuclear. In fact, it's almost at the surface sort of like a white dwarf, and we think that there are well-defined nuclei at the surface, probably iron nuclei at the surface. And then slowly, as the density increases, you go inward, these nuclei get closer and closer together. They eventually fuse, and it is energetically favorable for the particles to become neutrons. But you will still have some electrons and protons in the mix, even in the interior of the star. So it has a very complex structure, actually, very interesting.
Yeah. This is a good one, especially as you said, the neutron stars are better than an atomic clock. Will a neutron star keep spinning forever, or is there something around to slow them down?
So they actually slow down themselves. So I didn't say this, but if the star is producing all this radiation that it's sending all over the galaxy, there's the principle of conservation of energy. You can't just send out radio waves and all sorts of other stuff without giving something up. And we observe this regularly is that the stars actually are slowing down. So yes, they're comparable to atomic clocks, but atomic clocks, the frequency, the pulse, the time between pulses is fixed. The difference is in neutron stars, it's not. It's getting they're slowing down with time, and we think eventually they get so slow that the pulsar mechanism shuts off, and we think the galaxy is filled with dead neutron stars that we can't observe.
Here's another one that's kind of that same theme of when is the sun going to explode. What is the impact of the implosion of the supernova on the environment around it, and how far away from it, does it affect it?
Oh, like a supernova, what's the effect of a supernova on its environment? So that's a really great question. So in astronomy in general, in the galaxy in general, a supernova has impact on its on the surroundings. It sends shock waves into the interstellar medium. We think these shock waves sometimes hits gaseous clouds of material and can induce collapse of clouds that then produce more stars. That we think that could be a trigger for star formation, supernova shock waves. And they basically put energy into this interstellar medium, and there are people who do nothing but study the interstellar medium themselves, and supernova are a major contributor to the energetics and the motions of gas throughout the galaxy. But as to the question of, which might be more what you were wondering, what if a supernova went off really close to the Earth?
For example, in Betelgeuse.
That's kind of far away, so you don't have to worry about that. But closer than Betelgeuse, I don't know, like 10 times closer, it could get interesting, actually. So there is a theory that the extinction of the dinosaurs was due to a nearby supernova, because the radiation that the supernova produces would strongly, if it were close enough, it'd have to be really close, could sort of blow away our atmosphere. And so then the sun's radiation, the particular UV, which is generally filtered out, would fry us and other living creatures. But we don't think that is very likely to happen. And
less than 50%, so it should be okay. There's this is a whole list of questions here, and this one I don't even know if it has an answer. Can a pulsar help you estimate? Is it a standard candle for estimating distances in the universe?
Yeah, that's a great question. So
I have a suspicion where this question came.
There's a ringer in the audience. Yeah. So standard candle. That's a term for any object where you know intrinsically how bright it is. Because the big problem in astronomy is you don't know how far things are away. And if you take an object and you put it at extremely far away, but it's really bright, you might think, it's up close. So if you have we call it a standard candle. That's something where you know exactly how bright it is. Then if you move it further away, it looks fainter and so on. So you could know the distance to it. That's very important in astronomy. There's very few ways of doing that. Unfortunately, pulsars are not standard candles. It's terrible. The pulsars, if you take 100 of them and you put them at the same distance, they will appear to have very different brightnesses. And the reason for this could just be a beaming effect that, if the beam doesn't exactly hit you, first of all, it could totally miss you, and then the pulsar, you don't see it at all, even if it's right very close. But let's say the beam just grazes you. If it's just you just graze by that beam, it's going to look really faint, especially if the beam isn't like uniformly illuminated, and it's fainter at the edges of the beam than at the center. So some people think that the fact they're not standard candles is just a beaming effect, but it could also be just intrinsically. So the answer is no. Sorry.
No.
The short answer is no.
Here's an interesting one. So you mentioned if they go really fast, that puts limits on what a neutron star can do because you have some idea of how they form. What about a very slow one? Does that give you any limits on properties of neutron stars?
So unfortunately, no, because what happens is if you can look at the distribution of pulse periods, and it falls off at the long end. So slow pulsars are rare. And we think the reason for that is that as they slow down, the conditions required to produce the pulsations shut off. And so if you could detect one that was really, really long, you wouldn't. What you would basically learn is that, the pulse mechanism can function in those kind of pulsars. You might learn a little something, actually, I suppose.
This is one that I didn't get from your talk, but somebody in the audience did. If the Crab neutron star acts as a rotating beacon, why do we observe a double spot going through a cycle?
Because sometimes... Yeah, good question.
They're well chosen here.
Because sometimes the alignment is just right so that you see both magnetic poles. That's one reason.
Yeah.
If you understand. So think of Place Ville-Marie. So Place Ville-Marie, right? Montreal's pulsar. It actually has four. So it has four spots. And each time it goes, you might not have noticed that, but go ahead and look. And so in a pulsar, there's two magnetic poles. So if the alignment is just right, then you could see both. But there's another reason that we sometimes see. In fact, now I'm going to tell you, sometimes we see three spots. And then you're going to go, ooh. So the reason is that we also think that the beams are, they could be.
Yeah, I have it right here.
Okay, so like, let's say you're looking at the beam. In the picture I sort of drew you, it's just a uniform beam, so that if you observe it and your line of sight goes like this, you're going to see one pulse. But in fact, we think the beams are sometimes circular, so that if your line of sight goes through, you're going to see pulse. And this is supported by the fact that sometimes we'll see like a bright outer rim and then fainter in here. So when you cross it, you see pulse and then another pulse, and we see lots of pulsations that look like that, and then we see all sorts of other things. Sometimes we see it looks like there's another ring out there, so you'll see little pulse, big pulse, little pulse, all sorts of things we see out there. Most of them look like this, but sometimes you see this.
Okay, here's a nice straightforward question: how is all this information put to practical use?
Now, this is a very good question,
yeah.
And you know, it's important. And first of all, let me just make my spiel for basic science. That my personal feeling on this is that what really, you know. What is civilization? What does it mean to be a human being? To be curious and to wonder and to want to understand what's out there. When you look up at the sky and you go, what is that? What are those things? It's just natural, and I think it's a fundamental to being human, is to wonder. And but now, in terms of, if you don't accept that, let's say, what are the practical uses of this? Well, for one thing, I mean, I think it's inspirational. I think people, especially kids, when I give talks like this to kids, they're just, it's just, wow, that is cool. Oh, wow. You know, it's a way to promote science literacy, to get people excited about science. I think all of astronomy, but really other areas of science too, but this stuff in particular is very interesting. So I think it's important to do this kind of research for that reason. But if you really want practical things, it's not a complete stretch to think that one day pulsars could be used as navigational tools for traveling in space. And in fact, they've been patented to do that. Probably the patent will run out by the time they get around to it. But it is used in some cases for satellite navigation, for keeping time on satellites. By observing pulsars, you have a clock in the sky. You just need a little radio antenna, and you have a clock. You don't have to build in your own clock. It's possible that we may be able to create the ultimate time standard that is more precise than any one clock by using an ensemble of very highly stable rotating neutron stars, and there are people who are working on this currently. And then also just by understanding the nature of matter at very high density. Who knows, maybe one day you will be driving a car powered by a microscopic pellet of neutron star material. I don't know. That's kind of crazy. But maybe not. Maybe not. I mean, there's, when you're just understanding matter in extreme conditions, 300 years ago, people were playing with little bits of magnet and wires, and people would say, what are you wasting your time with? And they were discovering the laws of electricity and magnetism, which, give you your cell phone today. So does that answer the question?
That was good. That's
Thank
good.
You.
I'm afraid there's only time for one last question, which is mine. I'll do a little setup. 1908, Ernest Rutherford won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, actually, for work he did at McGill on transmutation of elements on the radioactive disintegration of thorium, I think it was alpha decay of thorium. And his collaborator on it was, he was in physics actually, although he got it in chemistry. His collaborator was a guy named Frederick Soddy, and he was in the Department of Chemistry, and they worked together on this. And Soddy won the Nobel Prize as well in 1921. So I wanted to go back to Jocelyn Bell. I've noticed sometimes that people don't win Nobel Prizes in the same year. Is there any possibility that something might happen with Dr. Bell in the future? And just to be clear on my endearment towards Dr. Bell, she is also a dean, so I have great fondness for such people.
I find it hard to second-guess the Nobel Committee. I highly doubt it, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, I don't remember the details of Soddy's Nobel Prize, but I would find it. I'd be surprised if it was for the exact same experiment that Rutherford
was. Yeah, it was.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
yeah,
there you go.
You can get it like 10 years later or something.
For the same thing?
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I guess you never know, but I would bet against it. So if you want to bet, we can go.
Well. On that, I'd like to thank everybody. First, of course, before I thank Vicky, because everyone will applaud then, I want to, applaud for other people as well, but I want to thank Wayne for phoning in half his lecture, like a month and a half early, but I'm really looking forward to his talks. It's going to be great, along with the other talks here. Next week will be Matt Dobbs, who's doing stuff on looking at the cosmic microwave background in the universe with a huge telescope, or not so huge, in Antarctica. I'd also like to thank Kathy for giving her great introduction to the whole mini-series and the background of the mini-series and where they came from. Thank you guys for being attentive. I'm sorry the room was too hot. With luck, maybe it will cool down in Montreal over next week, so next week will be nice and cool in here. Don't forget, please, to fill out the evaluation form so we can have some feedback to give and for future lectures in the series. And you can recycle your water bottles in the recycling bins outside. And with that, if we could thank Vicky one last time for a very nice talk.